Okay, good afternoon. So last time we talked about bit manipulation, particularly the kind that's exposed to you in something like C or assembly. We talked about strategies if you have some particular problem, like you might have next week during lab and the following homework, to do something with bit manipulation, starting with constructing a mask, applying bitwise operators, using shift to move things to the position you want them, and for efficiency to look for, and for correctness to look for subproblems so you can figure out how to do something in the first place, and for efficiency then look for ways of doing multiple operations at once, like we saw bitwise OR, it ORs all the bits. If you need to OR multiple things together, it'd be nice to have one bitwise OR operation do multiple of those bit ORings that you want to do eventually. We also ended with this exercise, which I'll go over again a little bit, but just briefly since we actually did discuss it. So any questions on any of the material from last time? Okay, so everyone's probably good. So with this exercise, the approach I recommend taking to be systematic about this is you can write down what happens with each part. So you can say, oh, this, it takes something, if it's bits A, B, C, D, E, F, it becomes 0, A, B, C, D, E, and this ending with 1, one is the only bit set, all the others are 0, ending keeps only the 1 bits, so we get E. And you can do that for all of these, and that would be how I'd go systematically about solving these. Write this out on paper, and that would be a good way of figuring out the answer to this question. You go through and figure out what happens to each of the bits by writing things down, and you see which of them match the pattern that we're actually looking for here, which I've written down this sort of reminder here, since it turns out that saying swap those bits is sometimes misinterpreted. You can do that for all of them. So if you're actually asked to solve this problem, you don't need to have your code be that I'm an expert in C one-liner, and I wouldn't recommend that. You can write out step by step with intermediate values, and if we ask you to do this sort of thing, this is what I recommend starting with. Everything named, this is the same as solution C, just written out with more lines. And it's much easier to figure out what's going on. So any questions on this or anything about that the exercise from last time? Okay. So before I move on, talk about one last thing in bit manipulation. I'd like to have an aside on the homework. So those of you who read the lab write-up for the in-lab quiz yesterday noticed that there's a follow-up homework. So the homework is that we're going to give you two random types of lists. One of them is a sentinel terminated array, so it's a pointer to some allocated memory where you know how much stuff is stored there because a special value is at the end, a value that we will never try to store in the list. One is a range, which is our name for a structure of a pointer to the actual data, and a separate size variable indicating how big it is. And the other is a linked list, which hopefully you've seen in some course before somewhere. And you have to write three functions. One is to convert from a first type to a second type, and the others are to modify a list of the second type. So one is to append one list of a second type to another. Another is to remove all elements equal to a value from a list of the second type. For the second two functions, you're supposed to modify the list pointed to by the first argument. So we'll give you a pointer to the list. If the list is represented by a pointer itself, this means you get a pointer to a pointer. If it's represented by a struct, this means you get a pointer to the struct. And you need to modify that list using the pointer we give you. And as a reminder, I showed this way earlier in the semester. These are the types of lists you're dealing with and the sort of layout they have in memory. You have our sentinel terminated array where you have a pointer, which is probably on the stack or in a register that points to some data with a special value at the end that we promise not to store, just like a string, except the value isn't zero. We have a range where we have a struct probably on the stack, which has a length and a pointer to the actual data. And we have a linked list, which you've probably seen before, where we're going to have a pointer either to a node of the linked list or to null if the list is empty. Okay, any questions on anything about the homework? Yes?
Is it the same format as the lab work?
So the question is the homework the same format as the lab? There are no restrictions like the lab on like using resources, though obviously you shouldn't share code, etc. But you're welcome to code on your own machine. We'll have an interface for that, which is like the lab interface, but like lets you upload and download files so you can test locally and things like that. Yes? So we would like you not to submit a lot. We're not going to define what a lot is, but we'll just say that we keep a copy of every single submission, and we would like not to even risk running out of space. Also, it's one server that's running everyone's code, so it would be nice if you were not submitting enough that other people's experience is going to be slower when they're trying to test their submissions. Okay, so before we talked about doing multiplication with the shift operator. This is our initial sort of replacement because multiplication was a thing equivalent to bit shifting that we knew how to do that worked. We also had the same with division. And it turns out that this multiplication idea works the same for signed and unsigned. Two's complement, it just works out, and you can prove this to yourself by knowing that if I do addition to add a number to itself in 2's complement, I get the same thing regardless whether it's signed or unsigned. 2's complement or unsigned, I get the same bit pattern, therefore it must be the same, doubling must be the same way either way, so the shifting that doubles will do the right thing. So this is for multiplication, but we also use the shift operators for division. And let's think about doing division with this. So let's say I have this code here, and that's incorrect. Let's say the red's there, I'm just not, didn't write it down. So this will give you the wrong answer. This is an attempt to do shifting, to do division. It's going to give the wrong answer, this assembly, so figure out what is this return and what's the correct answer supposed to be if we generated the correct assembly version of this function. Yeah.
You probably want to leave the first bit alone because that represents the sign, and so if you divide -32 by it.
Yeah. So you've answered part of the first question of what it does return. It returns something that is not negative.
No, and it might not even be the right number.
So well, if it's not negative, it can't possibly be the right number. Now, as for actually figuring out what the number is, well, you could write it out relatively easily in hexadecimal, but it's some giant integer that you'll get when you take shift -32. It's a giant positive integer. So that seems unfortunate. We have this great shortcut for division, which we established if you did it the normal way. It was really expensive. And we can't use it apparently because we care about negative numbers, which most of you would consider important a lot of the time. And sneakily, the examples I showed you earlier used unsigned numbers, so it didn't matter. And let's look at the bit patterns we have of these results. So the result we get is this giant number. We take minus 32 and shift it over. The result we want is negative 1. And you can see that there's a distinct place where there's a difference. And that's in these zeros we shifted in. So we had the observation that we want to keep the sign bit the same, certainly. Well, it turns out that it does exactly the right thing if only we shifted in ones instead of zeros in this case, because it's negative. This isn't entirely obvious, and you might say, maybe it's only true in this case because it's negative one is kind of special. Is that always going to be the case? So you can kind of show this by thinking about how would I use the non-working shift that we know about to divide negative numbers, knowing how Zuse complements work. So you start with a negative number, then you take it positive. So by flipping all the bits and adding one, then you'd right shift to do the division, then you'd flip all the bits and add one to get the actual correctly signed result. So what we're doing here, except for some adding one, which was going to be a small error, is we're flipping the bits, right shifting in zeros, and then flipping those zeros to ones. So everything but the bits we shift in, we flip twice, so that doesn't do anything. And the other bits, we flip from zero to one. This is how you can come to that conclusion that shifting in ones in this case is what we wanted to do, because it's negative. And there might be some rounding error because we have some adding one thing at the end here. Maybe we'll look at whether the rounding is not the what we want. But this is the logic you can come with of why this makes sense that we want to shift in ones in this case, and that just does the right thing. From that rule for Zuse complement, there's other ways you could have figured this out, other ideas about how Zuse complements works. That might be more straightforward. And this is a useful thing, since we now know how to do division correctly. And it turns out that x86 is going to provide us with an operator to do it. So there's something called an arithmetic right shift. So the other kind of right shift is called a logical. So these are names that x86 uses. You can see x86 is using it because it's SRA. That's what the A stands for. It doesn't mean you can't use the logical shift to do arithmetic. It doesn't mean you can't use the arithmetic shift to do logic stuff. There's just the names these operators have, and they're everywhere. So you'll commonly see this type of shift referred to as arithmetic, and the other kind referred to as logical. I didn't show the logical thing. So when it's signed, you want to shift in ones. When it's unsigned, you want to shift in zeros. And what that's equivalent to doing is just copying the sign bit for what we shift in instead of fixing always using zeros. So the arithmetic shift just copies the sign bit for those extra bits. And that does the right thing for both positive and negative when we're dealing with Zuse complements. So we saw our shift operator in C before. And it turns out that, yes, you can access this other shift in C2. And the way it works is that depending on whether you have an unsigned or signed value, the compiler is going to choose either the arithmetic one if it's signed or the logical one if it's unsigned. Okay. So any questions on anything about how this arithmetic shift works? what operation it does. Yeah.
So if you were to put shift sign and then put it in an unsigned integer into there, oh, that was the word, right?
So the question is, if I pass an unsigned integer for the shift sign, what happens? So that unsigned integer is conceptually converted to a signed integer when that happens, when you pass it. And in practice, what the compiled code is doing is that it's just using, because you declared it as signed here, it's just using the signed instruction. That's what making something signed versus unsigned causes the compiler to do. That's how it manifests the difference between signed and unsigned. And this means that what matters is what you declare it as, not anything about the value in particular. Okay, so that's the arithmetic shift operator. So if you just use a signed value, that's what you'll get. If you want the other one, you need to convert to unsigned explicitly. Okay, so I mentioned that this might not work the same as we want for rounding, that it might round in a different way. We didn't pay close attention to what was happening with the rounding, and we know there's this adding one and things like that. So, and it actually is different with respect to rounding. It's not an off by one thing, it's actually just rounds differently. So in C, the way the division operator is defined is that it rounds towards zero. It's supposed to truncate. This is what the people writing the C standard decided to make it do. If you do an arithmetic shift, you're gonna get division that round towards negative infinity. It always rounds down. And compilers would still like to convert your divide by 32 operator into something that uses this shift. Because as we mentioned, divide is really, really slow. So they don't want to do a real divide. So you can make an adjustment for this, and compilers know how to do this. So for example, this is actual code GCC will generate for that divide by 32 function. So what it does here is it computes 31 plus the value, so it would round differently. Then it sees if it's negative, and if so, if it's negative, it shifts 31 plus the value, otherwise it shifts the value. And this is just to adjust for that rounding problem, because we know we want to round in the opposite direction of what would happen naturally for negative numbers. Yes?
How is SRA and SAR and SRA different? Because on the previous slides it was SRA.
So the question is, how is the difference between SRA and SR?
And SAR.
Oh.
Is it supposed to be SAR?
It probably is. I mean, there might be an alias for it, but it's probably supposed to be SAR. There's not you asking a different question. So we'll do, yeah. Okay, so that's arithmetic shift. And that's how we use it to actually do fast division. And compilers, again, for as long as they can figure out that it's dividing by a power of 2, which they can't always do, of course, they'll try to do this, just because it's, even though this is a whole 4 instructions for a division, it's still going to be much faster. Yes?
Why 31?
Why 31? So we don't want to make, so if we start with negative 32, we don't want to make it go to zero. You want to make it still be negative one. Or still, no, we do want to make it go to zero. 30, yeah. Yeah, but negative 32 should still go to negative one, right? And if we added more than 31, you wouldn't get that. If we added less than 31, we wouldn't get that. We would get negative, we wouldn't get the right thing for like negative 33. which we don't want to be negative 2. And although negative 33 all the way to negative 63, we want to be negative 1, not negative 2. Yeah. Okay, so why 31? This is because 31 here. This is because we want 0 should go to 0, and negative 31 to 0 should also go to 0. And negative 32 is supposed to go to negative 1, and this is negative 32 all the way to negative 63. And this adjustment is what does that, given the wrong rounding, which the shift will do. Yes?
I just don't understand why you would add anything.
So if we start with negative 1, negative 1 divided by 32 is supposed to be 0 in C. If we don't add something, we're going to get negative 1 from shifting. Okay. So I kind of didn't say precisely what sine shifts do. So I told you that they do an arithmetic shift. So this is true on all compilers that I know of. But the C standard just says it's implementation defined, which is fancy words for saying the compiler needs to make a choice. It can't do different versions of the choice depending on how you optimize your code. It needs to do the same thing every time, but it needs to make a choice. So conceptually, there might be some strange compiler for some strange processor which does something different. But all compilers I know of do an arithmetic shift for signed values. The logical shift is required for unsigned values. You always will get that. So another miscellaneous note about shifts in C is that you would think, based on our description of shifts, that if you say take a 32-bit value and shift it over 32 places, that you'll get either all zeros or all ones in those bits. And that's a reasonable assumption, and that's not what the C standard says. The C standard says if you do that, that's undefined behavior, meaning different things might happen different times. And your program might even crash. And in x86 assembly, if you try to do this, the processor is just going to ignore the higher bits of your shift amount. So if you shift by 32, it's going to look at the bottom 5 bits of that 32, say, oh, you're shifting by 0. You shift by 33, it's going to look at the bottom 5 bits, say you're shifting by 1, and so on. And because what x86 does is a common thing, that's why it's undefined behavior. Because they don't want the compiler to have to generate extra code to say, is it greater than 32? If so, I need to do something special. They just want to use the instruction, which just doesn't allow larger widths. So any questions on any of this, what C actually does for shifting? So, a final note on bit manipulation. So there are some commonly implemented in processor bit manipulation operations, things that are easy for hardware to expose, which just haven't made it as operators in C. So one example is that XD6 in many architectures have as a rotate instruction, which is like shifting, but instead of shifting in zeros or ones or copies of the sign bit, it just takes what you would got clocked off the number, what bits got shifted away, and puts them on the other side of the number. It's like putting the bits in a barrel and around a cylinder and moving them a little bit. It's also common to have an instruction to identify the index of the first or last bit that's set in the number. This is an operation that turns out to be very useful and relatively easy to do in hardware, but kind of annoying to do with just bitwise operators efficiently. And similarly, something called population count, which is just what is the number of bits set in something, you can do this with bitwise operators. This will in fact be a homework exercise. But even those kind of clever solution that takes advantage of parallelism of the sort we mentioned is not that great, and hardware can do it a lot better, and it's a common enough operation that some recent extensions to x86, well, not that recent anymore, but some relatively recent extensions have added an instruction to do it, and this also exists in many other architectures. Even though there's no way of writing this in C. Yeah?
What's an example when you would use rotate?
So the question is, what's an example of when you would use rotate? So all the examples I know of that are like direct uses are in cryptography, where just some things in cryptography are defined to use it because it's easily available. I'm sure there's some like arithmetic useful use, but I'm not sure what it is off the top. I don't do that type of coding enough to know. Okay, so any questions about anything about bit manipulation before we move on to talking about hardware? Any bit manipulation, confusion? Okay, great. So let's start talking about building a processor out of hardware components. So we're going to talk about probably the most important kind of component we're going to deal with when we're making processors, which is registers. And we saw this very briefly earlier in the semester. So let's talk about how these work. And I'm going to show these timing diagrams here, which have colors to represent different values, rather than writing out some value that would be hard to read over time. And what a register does is it stores a value and outputs the value it has stored. And there's a clock signal. So we're not going to draw where the clock wires for the clock signal, but they exist physically. But there's a clock signal connected to basically all our components. And whenever the clock signal has a rising edge, so it goes up in voltage, the register is going to read its input and make that the new thing it outputs, the new thing it's storing. So all that matters for the register to determine what it outputs is what it's being input just as the rising edge of the clock happens. So there are other types of registers you might know of if you've had other courses. That is very convenient, but we will not be dealing with them. And what? I don't think that's a fire alarm. But I think that's I think that's some sort of fire alert. I'll use the board if I really have to, but I hope to get this working. So that's the type of register we're going to deal with. So we're going to use registers directly for two important components of our processor. So one of them is the program counter, which we'll often call the PC. The program counter represents, see if that works, stores the address of the instruction we're currently running. So, and we obviously need to know that in order to execute an instruction. The other thing we'll directly use a register for is implementing condition codes. We need to store the ZF and SF bits. The type of thing we want to use to do that is a register. Okay. So, yeah. Okay. So we have some other pieces of state we need to worry about. So another thing is that we have actual things we call registers in assembly. Those need to be stored somewhere. So we're going to give you a pre-built component, which you could build yourself from registers and logic, but you won't have you do that, called a register file, which is going to contain all our RAX, our RSP, R12, etc. It's all going to be in there, and we're going to access them through the signals that it provides. We're also going to have memories. Most notably, we're going to have an instruction memory. Our instructions are stored in memory. We need something to retrieve them from. So we'll retrieve them from this instruction memory. There's also going to be a separate data memory. So this data memory is going to be where we're going to retrieve data that instructions access. So the for example, MR move Q and R move Q. We're going to read for them or write to memory for them using the data memory component. Now, you'll notice that we have two memories. And you might think, well, there's only one thing stored at a memory address in my computer. Why do you have two memories? What's going on? So we're going to resolve that much, much later in the semester. But for now, our assumption is that these two memories, they're separate physical components, because that's going to make implementing our processor way easier. But they're actually secretly synchronized. We'll talk about what's actually happening a bit much later in the semester. We'll talk about what the memories really look like. Yes? So what's the clock? So we is the question. So the clock is what tells how we know when to advance our state. So it's going to be set to go periodically based on just how fast we can run our computation. But we want to run step after step after step because that's what a program is. The clock is going to control when we take each step. So it is technically possible to build circuits that do like run programs and don't have a real clock, but that is not something we're going to discuss in this course, and it is a very difficult thing to do. Yeah.
Could you just go over quickly again what the instruction memory and what the data memory, what they store?
So what are the instruction memory and data memory store? So these both access the same memory, same array of bytes. The instruction memory is where we're going to retrieve instructions from, so the actual machine code. The data memory is what we're going to use when an instruction tells us, I want to write a register to memory, I want to read from memory into a register. That's what we're going to use to access that. Since we can't access the instruction memory to read the instruction and to read data from memory at the same time. Yes? What would be the advantage of having a computer without a clock? The question is, what would be the advantage of having a computer without a clock? The advantage would be that maybe it could be like lower power or something like that. This is a question which involves a lot of, you know, sort of EE stuff that I'm not an expert on, but that is my understanding of why people are even interested in the idea. And not a clock might be more something like, or something like maybe something, lots of things which look like clocks might be there still in some form. Okay. So we mentioned memories. So what do our memories do? So for this class, our memories are going to have an interface that looks like this. We'll talk later on about what memories more realistically look like. But for now, the way, or something like our instruction memory works, where we're just reading values, is that there's a bunch of wires that go into the instruction memory with an address. And when we put in an address, sometime later, we get out the data at that address, which is hopefully some machine code. And note that this sometime later doesn't depend on there being any sort of clock signal doing anything in particular. It's going to happen within a clock cycle. So our data memory is more complicated because we need to do both reading and writing. So we're going to have an address input, which is the address we're either reading or writing. We never need to do both at the same time. And also, if we're writing, we have an input which is the value we want to write. If we're reading, we have an output which is the value being read. Now, these output inputs and outputs still exist. If we're not reading and writing, they're just not doing anything. We're going to ignore the values on them. Now, we also have to control whether we're reading or writing. So we'll have some additional inputs indicating whether I want you to read right now or whether I want you to do a write right now. So writing to memory is going to work very similar to writing to a register. We're going to put some value in the address input, put some value on the value input, and whenever there's a rising edge of the clock, This memory is going to look at those values and update memory, and not at any other time. So reading happens within a clock cycle. Whenever we change the address input, we get a new output some short amount of time later. Writing only happens when there's a rising edge of this clock signal telling us to advance. Any questions on how these memories work? Okay. So our register file is going to generally look, I'm going to draw it like this. We have a whole bunch of inputs and some outputs because we need to do more things with registers than we do with memory. So we have some inputs where we specify the number of a register we want to read. And similar to the memory, after we specify that register number some short time later, the corresponding output gives us the value of that register with some time within the same clock cycle. And we have multiple of these because we have some instructions which need to read multiple registers, like add. We want to read two registers, so we have two inputs, so we can do that without doing them on separate clock cycles. We also have some inputs which let us write a register. And they work similarly to how we write with the data memory. We have an input specifying the number of the register we want to write and the value we want to write. And just like with data memory, at the rising edge of the clock, the register file effectively looks at those values and modifies one of the stored registers. So missing from this is any way to control whether we write or not. So the way we're going to do that is we're going to specify the special register number 15, which, if you remember, we weren't using. And this is why we weren't using it. So we can now have a way of specifying don't write a register. We could have instead had 16 registers, but then we need an extra signals into the register file. So if we specify register number 15 and we try to write, the register file is just going to do nothing. If we try to read it, our convention is that we're always going to get zeros out. Any questions on anything this register file does? Yes?
Wait, so reading, it happens in one cycle?
So the question is, reading happens in one cycle? Yes. Happens within a cycle. Doesn't depend on the clock signal at all. Yes? So the question is, there are two pairs of arrows? Yes, we can read two values at once, and we can write two values at once. Why two values? Because we have many instructions which need to read two registers, and we have one instruction which needs to write two registers. And we need to build a register file that can handle the worst case instruction for this type of processor design we'll be starting with. Yes? So the question is, if there are any enable inputs? No. So we always read, and that's not a problem because reading is going to be cheap for the register file, and if you don't use the value being read, okay. And for writing, we use that special register number 15. That's the replacement for having a write enable input for the two data inputs. Any other questions? Okay, so there's one more component that's not a state component that our book talks about, which is ALUs. ALU stands for Arithmetic Logic Unit. And it's the thing which does computation. So in our processor, we need to do additions, subtractions, XORs, and maybe more operations. We can look through our instruction set and figure that out. And this is the thing which is going to take two values and do some operation, which I represent with this italicized op. So we input some value A and some value B. Perhaps this would be input coming from the register file. That would be a reasonable thing to do. And we also have an input to select which of the operations we're doing, which hopefully is some function of what instruction we're trying to execute. And based on all those inputs, the ALU within the same clock cycle outputs the result of the operation. And for now, we'll just only be worrying about ALUs which work within a clock cycle. You may infer from me telling you that divide takes many cycles, that real processors have things like this which might take multiple cycles, take variable amounts of time. For our processor design, we're just going to start with one where it always happens within a clock cycle. We're just going to make our clock cycle as long as it needs to be for that to happen. We'll talk later on about ways of designing processors where not every instruction needs to fit in a clock cycle. So any questions about what the ALU does? Okay, so given that we have our components, let's talk about how we will put them together and make a processor. So I could do what the book does and start by like dividing all our instructions into pieces and then working out the wiring for each piece, but I'm gonna try a different and hopefully easier to follow approach by starting with just a subset of the instructions. And a really, really, really small subset. So let's start by looking at how we make a processor with only an add instruction. And since we only have one instruction, we don't even need opcodes. So our instruction encoding is just going to be 1 byte, where 4 bits of that byte are one of the register numbers, 4 bits are the other. It's the only kind of instruction we have. We don't need any opcodes, anything else. You don't have any other instructions. So let's build this processor from the components we talked about. So a good first step would be, which of those components do we actually need? So what do we need of the state pieces we talked about? Yeah. So we need an ALU, so that, yeah. So we need the register files because we have register numbers. Probably should go somewhere, yeah. So we need the instruction memory because we need to read those register numbers. So there's one more component that's important. Yeah.
The data memory.
What do we need the data memory for? So to store the results of each instruction. So this would be true if we had x86 as out instruction. But the out instruction I've written here, this is the only form we're going to care about. Just like in y86, it's only going to registers. Yeah, the program counter. We need to remember what instruction we're on and keep track of what instruction we're, so we can execute the right instruction in the program as we go step by step. So we need some place to store that. So those are our components. I haven't drawn the ALU yet, but we'll add it later. So we have our program counter, our instruction memory, and our register file. So conceptually, the first thing we're going to do when we run this instruction is we want to read the actual instruction we're writing. We have to know what we're doing. This is what you do by hand from where it's stored, which is the instruction memory. So what connection do we need to make to do that? Or what wire should we add? Yeah. Yeah, so our program counter, remember, stores the address of the instruction we're working on, and registers always output the value they currently have stored. And we want to use that value to access the instruction memory. The instruction memory's input is the address to read right now. So we do that, and now the instruction memory's output has our two register numbers. And they're register numbers, so we probably want to send them to the register file. So our next connection is going to be that we're going to take the output from the instruction memory and split it into pieces, since we have separate inputs. And one of those pieces is going to be the register number we want to read, one of the register numbers we want to read, the other is going to be the other one. And we need to hook that up so we read the correct registers, which is conceptually the next thing you would do if you were at running this instruction by hand, as you look at your wherever you wrote down the register values and copy those. So after we pass the register numbers to the register file, it's going to output them on the corresponding outputs. So on these pictures of register file, I have named the inputs for what we read, source A and source B. This is because our book does it, not because I think these are great names. And I've marked the corresponding outputs this way, R, that's for registers of with number source A and register with number source B. And similarly, DESTY here is a write input, destination register number, and this is where the input for the next value of that register number goes. So we have our two register outputs, which are the registers we want to read, and we need to use our ALU to add them, because that's what the only type of instruction we support does. So we're going to take those two values and connect them to an ALU. And we can just hardwire the select input of that ALU to do an app, because that's the only instruction we care about. So then what do we need to do to actually store that result? So we have an ALU, yeah.
Data memory?
So we established earlier that we're not supporting the x86 add instruction, which might write to memory. We're supporting only the y86 register to register one. So our result's going to be stored in a register. So what does that mean we do? Yeah.
It'd be the second register that you brought in, so you just bring the result of the ALU computation into the destination value thing, like there too.
Yeah, so one thing we need to do is we need to connect the result of the computation, as mentioned, to the value input to the register, which I have labeled next RDSD. So there's another thing we need to do, which is you need to set the corresponding register number to write input, which I've labeled as DESD, to be equal to that register number. So we need to put that part of the output of the instruction memory, which has that register number, into two places in the register file, both for what we need to read and what we need to write. Yeah?
Isn't DESD also, if we're doing add, it should be one of the source registers?
And it is. So the question isn't it always also one of the source registers? And it is, because they're connected to the same wire. So it has the same value, but the register file design we discussed has different inputs for read and write. We could maybe have a register which doesn't do that, but that doesn't seem actually useful when you start thinking about some of the instructions we have where we don't always want to write a value. Okay. So let's look at what happens when we try to, we execute a whole add. So it looks like we're set. So let's say we're running this program. We read the instruction here, RAX, RDX. We get those values. We put RAX as source A. So now we get RAX out here, the value of RAX. We put the number for RDX as source B. So we get the value of RDX here. In this example, let's say that means we do 1 plus 3. So we get 4 on here. And we're specified to write to RDX. So then a rising edge of the clock happens. And now RDX contains 4 because of how our register file works. And let's think about other components that do things on rising edge of a clock. We have one, which is the program counter, which is going to copy its input to its output on the rising edge of the clock. And we don't have an input. So this doesn't work, because we need to supply an input to the program counter so it knows what to do when there's a rising edge of the clock. So what should that input be? So our instruction encoding is exactly this RX register number, register number. So this is 1 byte, And we expect, after running the instruction at address 0, that the next instruction we want is to run at address 1. So we probably should just add 1 to the address of the instruction we're running. So where can we find the address of the instruction we're running? This picture. Yeah. From the program counter. It's on this wire that we have going out of the program counter. So we just need to take the value on that wire, put it into something which is going to add 1, and send that back to the program counter. So when the rising edge of the clock happens, it copies the value plus 1, and we execute the next instruction. We don't have any jumps or anything like that, so we don't need to deal with any other cases. So now we have an actual complete processor where if we run that program, it will keep running and execute instructions as we expect. Yes? So
what would it actually do if it was larger than 1 byte is it would add the number of bytes or something?
Yes, so if our instructions weren't 1 byte, we need to add a different size to advance to the next instruction in memory. So any questions about this processor here? Any of the things we did? Yeah.
So the first one you add IX or DX, can you get 3? Okay, yeah.
So first one we read RAX is 3, RAX is 1, RAX is 3, we add them together, get 4. And that sits on this input until the rising edge of the clock happens when RDX changes. Yeah. Okay. So we'll see if you have questions later. So we'll go through a different example. Another subset of our Y86ISA. So instead of having one instruction that's an add, let's have one instruction that's a jump. And we'll use the simplest encoding here, since we don't have multiple instructions, we don't need opcodes. So our encoding is just an 8-byte address to jump to. That's what our instructions are. So our processor, what components do we need to do this? Of the ones we discussed. Do we need a program counter? Yes. Do you need an instruction memory? Yes, because we better be able to read these values. Do we need the data memory? No. We only need to read the instruction that tells us everything we need. Do we need the register file? No. There's no register numbers mentioned or affected by this instruction. So all we end up needing is the PC and the instruction memory. And our first step always is to take the value of the program counter and pass it to the instruction memory to read the machine code so we know what to do. And what we read is exactly the address of the instruction we want to run next. So we just send that value directly back to the PC. So when the rising edge of the clock happens, it copies that value, and we start running the instruction with that address. So we could have a program here, and this would advance. Every rising edge of the clock, we execute the next jump instruction. So any questions on how this jump CPU works? So now we can do flow control, kind of. So something we're missing here is that, you know, I have instructions where I can jump somewhere and ones where I don't, but I haven't put them together. And to put them together, we're going to need, or we're at least going to use, another type of hardware component. And this is something called a multiplexer. And we're going to use this a ton this semester for lots of things. And this is the hardware way of basically doing an if-then-else statement. So a multiplexer takes in a bunch of inputs and has an output of the same size, and another input where I'm going to call select. And based on the value of the select input, we choose one of the inputs to put in our output. So in this case, if the select input is 0, we output A. The select input is 1, we output B. The select input is 2, we output C, and so on. And this is what the building block we're going to use to choose between multiple values. And a common case we might want to do that is for some types of instructions, we want a value from one place. For others, we want a value from another place. This is what we'll use to have both of those values wired to the same place without, you know, actually trying to wire them both, which wouldn't work electrically. Let us choose based on the instruction. The way we choose based on the instruction is by setting that select input to the appropriate function of the instruction. We make some logic which produces 0, 1, 2, or 3 appropriately based on what the opcode of the instruction is. Any questions on how muxes work? Okay, so, all right, and you can write this out as a truth table, so you can look at this as a big logic gate, too. That's another way of viewing muxes. Okay. So now that we know about muxes, let's make a processor which actually has two instructions, instead of just one. And the instructions I'm going to choose are jump, so we just saw how to do jump by itself, and not. Which is unlike jump, it goes to the instruction after it in memory, not to one specified by an address. So here, this processor is going to need to make a choice based on the opcode, that first 4 bits, the 7 or the 1, which type of instruction we're running, and therefore what type of value do I pass to the program counter? Do I want to pass something added to the program counter for the NOP, or do I want to pass something from the instruction memory for the jump? So we start out the same way, but we're going to have this mux because we need to make that choice. So we add a mux, and we set the inputs to the mux based on the I code. So we have some piece of logic, which if it's a jump, gives us a 1. If it's any other opcode, gives us a 0. This is something you can figure out how to build from bitwise operations and therefore in logic gates. We're not going to have to deal with the details of building that, but you just need to know that that's a function you can make out of logic. So in the case of the jump, we're going to want to select this input, which is part of the instruction we read. In the case of the NOP, we're going to want to add something to the program counter, the size of a NOP, which is going to be 1 byte in this case, and we're going to want to set that. So when we're executing a NOP, the input to the selector on this mux is 0, so that basically it connects the top input to the output. When we're executing a jump, it connects the bottom input to the output. And so this is how we get a processor that now can execute a choice of instructions. Not a particularly interesting choice, but we'll use muxes like this throughout our processor. Basically, any time we need to do something different based on what kind of instruction it is, the solution is you, instead of connecting, say, our destination value directly to the PC, you put a mux in front of it to make that choice. Any other time we have a component where we need to make a choice about what the input is, we add a mux in front of it, make the inputs of the muxes be all our possible choices, and choose appropriately based on the opcode. Yes?
Why do you split?
So why do we split? So what is our instruction memory outputting?
It's outputting either a jump or
a jump. The jump or not. Yeah. So what does the jump look like in memory? I have it actually written on the slide here.
So it's 7, 0, and the destination.
Yes, and we only want to pass the destination to the program counter. So that's why we need to split it. can't just pass the whole thing. Also, we only want to really use the opcode piece, this 1 or 7, to decide what to do. We don't actually need the rest, though obviously we could try to pass it to a circuit which does that. But that would be wasteful. So one thing you might notice, which is a common complaint, is that when I'm executing a NOP instruction, I must be, because this wire is wide enough for a jump, be reading all this extra stuff in memory. And yes, I am. And that's not a problem, because yes, that extra stuff in memory is going to end up here. But when we're executing a NOP, we're going to take this value, it goes into this mux and stops. Doesn't go end up anywhere. So it doesn't matter that we read all that other stuff. We're not going to use it, so it's OK. And we're not going to make an instruction memory where we tell it how many bytes we want to read in some way. We're going to keep things simple and just have it always read the maximum we might need to read. Yes?
What is NOP?
What is NOP is the question. So NOP stands for no operation. So it does nothing except advance to the next instruction, like any instruction does. And I chose it because it's the simplest instruction, and probably even too simple for me to use for the first example of the app. Yeah? Sorry, so the question is what does the one if jump, zero if NOP represent? So that represents a circuit which takes the opcode and outputs one if it's a jump opcode, zero if it's not.
Oh, so it doesn't matter if it's like different.
What, sorry, what? It doesn't matter if.
It doesn't matter if so that's not related to this zero after this.
So yes, it's not related to the 0-4 bits in the instruction.
Oh, it's like an output.
So that's the out. Yeah, that's describing what the output of that is based on its input, which is an opcode. In this case, 1 or 7.
Oh.
So it basically it translates 7 into 1 and 1 into 0. And I'm just not drawing logic gates to do that because that would not be worth your time. Okay, any other questions on our CPU here? Yes.
So this is like a CPU with only those two operations?
Yeah, so this is a CPU which only implements those two operations. Yeah, that's what it is. And our other CPUs were ones which implemented even less operations. So next time we will get to how do we implement all the operations we care about in YD6. But I want to start off simple, because it's easier to understand why things are connected the way they are with these very, very simple CPUs that are obviously completely useless, because you can't actually compute anything with NOP and jump. Okay, so. Here's a little exercise. So I showed you how to do NOP and jump together. Now let's think about doing NOP, that no operation instruction, and add together. So we saw how to make an add CPU, and we know how to implement NOP from seeing it in the NOP and jump CPU. So let's say we want to make NOP and add together. Where are we going to need to put muxes? So I would recommend writing things down. You might draw things and try to figure this out and check with your neighbor to see if you agree. And more than one of these might be right. Yes. Yeah, I see a question. You have a question or an answer?
So, like, the non-answer.
Yeah.
So for not, like, if you go back to the previous slide, you said, like, it's like plus one, so it skips.
Yeah, so we have to skip not because the instruction we want to run after not is the one that's here in memory, right after it in memory. And that's what the plus one is for.
So what I was wondering, so like after the PC, yeah. Like it goes
up, right? So we always compute PC plus one in this circuit. We just don't use the value we compute if it's a jump. So we always compute this, the address of this part of memory, but if it's a jump, we just put it into the mux and it goes nowhere. And if it's not, we put it into the mux and that's what we actually send to the program counter's input. People are remarkably quiet for asking to check with your neighbor about answers. There's some of you who have neighbors. Okay. Who has some idea about whether one or more of these is true or false? Okay, a couple people. Who has no idea how to even start? Okay, so a way I would start is by drawing out what does the CPU for not look like, what does the CPU for add look like, and basically you want to combine them. So you, then when you look at combining them, you say, where is there a conflict in what we're passing to a components? That's what you're looking for here. Wherever you're trying to say, pass one thing to the, to say a register file input and the other one wants another thing, then you need a mux in the act to actually implement both of these instructions. So that's how I would go about systematically solving this. like not to do this for too long.
No.
Okay. Because people should read the options. Okay, who has an answer to at least one of these? At least two? Three? All of them? Okay, not ready for all of them. So who would like to tell me that one of these is definitely needs a mux or does not need a mux? Any one of them. Start with presumably the easiest one. Yeah.
The program counter does not need a mux.
Program counter, you say, doesn't need a mux, so why not? So we're just incrementing it. So, yeah, so this is unfortunately something which is a bit underspecified. So if our encodings look like they do in YAD6, unfortunately, we need to do something about the instructions having different lengths. If we had some encoding where they had the same length, we wouldn't. So here there's a question of instruction length. So we need to deal with that somehow. Probably it's by putting a mux right before it. Maybe it's by having a circuit which computes the length and an adder, which wouldn't be a mux. But we need to do something to deal with that. It's a way in which what we're passing to the program counter is different between the two instructions. Yeah, or there's, I guess, the third solution of just make the instructions all the same length, which would also be fine. And this is an example of why RISC is easier. Okay, any other ones people want to volunteer answer? Yeah. Before the instruction memory's address input? So we need to pick which instruction we execute, this is true. But where do we figure out, how do we know that before? How do we know that on this processor? So here, it's wired to the program counter register. And we're just gonna use the program counter to store the address of the instruction no matter what kind it is. So we don't need to make a choice even though we're doing different things. We also are always going to read the maximum instruction size, no matter what kind it is, so we don't need to make some sort of other input to the instruction memory to say how much to read, which would be reasonable to think we do, but that's just not how we're going to implement our processor. Yes?
Would you need one before C?
Before the register number to write. Yes, so remember how a register file works. It looks at the register number you're inputting, the rising edge of the clock, and writes to it. And if you don't want that to happen, which probably we don't want the NOP instruction to change a register's value, that would be non-intuitive, to say the least, then we need to have something in front of there to out-input a value other than whatever happens to be in memory here. Like, that's not part of the instruction, but if we are running an add, that's what we'd expect to be inputting there. We don't want that value to be there. If there's a NOP following NOP, we don't want to write to register number one. We want to write to the special register number indicating no register to write to. So yes, we have a non-register number. And if as long as we set the register number correctly to indicate not to write when we don't need it, we don't need a mux in front of the register value, because it will be ignored in the NOP like we want, and it won't be ignored in the add like we want. And I think, yeah, that deals with all of them but A. So A, we're gonna, if we don't put a mux in front of it, we're always gonna read registers, even though NOP conceptually doesn't need to. But as long as we don't use the value we read, that's fine, and reading registers is not expensive, so usually we won't do that, though you could put a mux in front of it to specify the non-register number. That wouldn't be like very bad, it's just not necessary.